What story are you telling? Whether you're intentional about it or not, you have an audience and they think in story. The Doug Thompson Podcast features diverse storytellers sharing their practical tips for telling the story they need others to envision and trust in order to take a new action. Here's your host, Doug Thompson.
And that dawned on me, you know, 3 or so years ago, that response. And I said, you know, after COVID especially, there are a lot of adults out there in a hopeless, what they seem as a hopeless situation. How do I fix that? How do I offer them hope without just words? You know, how can I really get them hope? And that's when I started studying hypnotherapy very intensely in its modalities, because the answers do lie within us, but they're trapped under a layer of negativity that was seated in us when we were young, either by parents, peers, teachers, bullies, whoever.
Hey, and welcome to the Doug Thompson Podcast. My guest this week is Deborah LeBlanc. Now, if you do a Google search on her, the first thing will come up is her work as a horror author, an author in a horror genre, where she's written several books and was president of sort of the Guild, I believe is what it's called. But she's transformed this into what a real passion in life was, and this is, again, part of the hero's journey. Real young, she thought she wanted to be a nun or a psychiatrist. And as you'll hear through here, she sort of transformed her story into the next chapter of being a licensed hypnotherapist. But she uses that, as you heard in the preview, sort of help people unlock their story from the mush that's in their head, from the stuff that has happened in life. And the conversation flowed. We grew up close to the same culture around us. We grew up about 50 to 70 miles apart, me in Southeast Texas and her in the middle of Louisiana around Lafayette. But we share a lot of great stories. She just a wonderful storyteller, and you'll learn to connect with this. You'll learn to connect with your story, but it'd be interesting to see what do you pull out of this? What do you get out of it? Because like everything else, if you're opening to listening to things and learning from other people, I think you'll learn a lot from this episode of the Doug Thompson Podcast. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the Doug Thompson Podcast. I am your host, Doug Thompson. And my guest today is sort of hard to put in a box because she's done so many different things. We grew up, or we lived, we're less than 100 miles from each other. I grew up in East Texas, and she grew up in Lafayette, Louisiana, or is from that area. I passed by there several times. I've been to the Rice Festival in Crowley. Those of you who know who that is. So we share a lot of background and from a cultural perspective and all that, but I want to introduce you, Deborah LeBlanc. Deborah, how are you doing this morning?
I'm doing great, Doug. And I appreciate you having me on your podcast.
Well, I love talking to a neighbor, and really that's, you know, if you're from South Louisiana and Southeast Texas, we're neighbors, you know, it doesn't.
Oh, yes. Yes. Mean it.
We share a lot in hurricane season. We share a lot of crawfish. We share a lot of stuff. That goes on there, and you've got such an interesting background and stuff. So I'll let you start the journey, because I know there's jumping off points and segues all along the way. So tell us a little bit about how we got here today.
Oh my gosh, it is a long winding road, and I'm gonna try to be as concise as I can, but it's been a crazy road. I grew up always wanting to be, as we were talking, sharing a little bit earlier, I was growing up wanting to be either a nun or a psychiatrist. And it didn't take long, as I got into my teen years, that nun was not going to fly. Okay. So I thought, well, you know, psychiatry always fascinated me. And one of the reasons it did was because my parents had split up when I was very young. My mother, I think, was an undiagnosed manic depressive. And so she was like living with an explosion always waiting to happen. And I acted as a shield for my brother and sister because she would get very physical. And I think that was my desire, was understanding I didn't look at her so much as a mother who was not acting like a mother, but a woman in pain that someone wasn't helping. Because back in those days, you could doctor hop and pick up pain meds and sedatives and blah, blah, blah. It didn't matter if you had a cabinet full. They weren't tracking you by computer. She was addicted to pain medications. And so it was tough growing up. I got married at 16, not because I had to. I had my first daughter at 18. And it was probably around the age of 21, I realized I married my mother. No, not, she wasn't female. He was not female. He was just not husband material or father material. We eventually wound up with three daughters. And I knew that if I didn't go to work, we were going to wind up on the welfare line. My mother, excuse me, my mother, I grew up after the separation in the projects. We were on food stamps, which back in there, in that day, were not the fancy cards. It was literally paper stamps of different colors that denoted different denominations. And my mother was always too embarrassed to go into the grocery stores to pay for it, so she'd send me. Yes, like I wasn't embarrassed because my schoolmates were in there oftentimes and would see me paying with food stamps. So I was a lonely childhood. I just kind of hung out by myself. And I didn't want that for my kids. I knew if anything was going to change, I was going to have to really go to work. My background was in marketing. I have a degree in marketing. So I went into the oil field business. That's where you made money back then. I worked for a transportation company for about 12 years, became the first VP, executive VP of transportation in the US after I'd been with them for about 8 years, and then left them to start my own company, which was Central Control Systems. We monitored underground fuel tanks around the US and Canada. And that road provided very well for my children. It lasted well. I sold it a couple of years ago, but that was only after I lost two of my daughters and 1 3-year-old grandbaby. Soon after that, I lost my dad and my younger brother. So within a 5-year span, it was one tumble after another. I really took a step back and wanted to know, what do you want to do with your life? You're way too young to retire. And I had been through a lot of drama, blah, blah, blah. But I'm not the kind that says, you know, well, I grew up this way, so I can be this. Bum equals bum, you know, and kind of suck off the system. I was just not that type. And I started looking just, I was literally turning in circles. Where do you fit? Well, what are you supposed to be doing now? And something just plopped in my lap one day. And it was to a university that had a program for hypnotherapy. And I started looking into it. And I said, it just a light went on in my head. And it said, I couldn't go back to school to become a psychiatrist after all those years, because one, by the time I got out, you know, I was going to be in a nursing home. And, you know, what clientele was I going to have? Those with dementia, that's it. So I looked into hypnotherapy and went back to school, became a certified hypnotherapist, and of course did not stop there. I became a master NLP practitioner, a master therapeutic imagery practitioner, an MER practitioner, and everything that was in there that had the word certified master, I wanted it because I saw the difference that it made in so many people's lives. And the only thing that I've ever wanted to do was give people out in this world who seemed hopeless, stuck, a chance to feel real hope. to feel that somebody cared and wasn't only after what was in their pocket, you know? When I was working, when my book started selling, of course, your publisher does not put you on a bandwagon and send you off with flags and balloons. You do that yourself. You put your feet on the street. Well, I did 36 states in 3 months and probably 150 bookstores. And every bookstore I went into, I would ask a group of teens who were normally huddled in the little coffee shop area, what do you like to read? Who's your favorite author? And 98% of the time, no matter what state I was in, I'd hear the same thing. I don't like to read. I just come here and hang out with my friends. It was a safe out from the parents, you know, it's like going to the library. Only there they could look at, you know, hottie magazines or hot rod magazines or whatever. Well, my last drive was from Seattle back to Louisiana. And during that drive, I came up with Literacy Inc., which is a nonprofit that I created. And I said, there are only three things that age group's interested in. That was either money, music, or sex, right? Music and sex, they could just turn on the internet. There you go. So money, I was going to have to somehow tie money into the mix. So I created a program where if you finish this book, answer these questions, you could win $5,000. It worked for a while, but you, no, you wouldn't be amazed. You probably know the attention span of someone 14, 15 is about that of a gnat. So unless that $5,000 is really, they're really hungry for it, they would give up after the third or fourth. They were going to hang with their friends. If they needed $5,000, which they had no concept of how much money that was, then they'd ask mom or dad. So I changed it. I began to realize that in order to get, I'm looking at a whole generation of kids that didn't read. These kids one day were going to lead our country. What was going to be on that big knob that says, for the nuclear bombs, it says, you know what, nuke them? It's going to be, you know, N-U-K or N-U-X or heaven only, heaven forbid. So I don't know why I felt personally responsible for doing something about it. I visited high schools around the country and spoke to thousands of high school students, auditoriums full of students, and didn't tell them the story about why they should read and blah, 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 blah. I told them my story, my background, and how reading saved my life and helped me to realize that you could be more than what you're used to living. It was more than what your parents may be. It was beyond the scope of what even you thought you were at that very moment. There was such a response from that. There were kids running from the bleachers to get books, to grab books, just to work, some crying, sobbing, because it was as I was touching kids that who had been where I had been, who were where I had been back then. And that dawned on me, you know, 3 or so years ago, that response. And I said, you know, after COVID especially, there are a lot of adults out there in a hopeless, what they seem as a hopeless situation. How do I fix that? How do I offer them hope without just words? You know, how can I really get them hope? And that's when I started studying hypnotherapy very intensely in its modalities, because the answers do lie within us, but they're trapped under a layer of negativity that was seated in us when we were young, either by parents, peers, teachers, bullies, whoever. And by working with these people, I can help them realize the true them they were meant to be. And it has been so rewarding in just seeing a person who walks into, well, they don't walk into my office because COVID and the new variant, we do it over Zoom. And it's just seeing a person's eyes that are dead when they meet you for the first time. And by the end of the first session, they're bright, they're alive, they're hopeful. They're a little skittish because it's like, I've been tricked before. Is this real? And they'll come back for another session and they get better and better and stronger and realize it is them. It's not something I'm doing except helping them turn those negatives that are buried so deep in their subconscious into positives. They go out and do some phenomenal things even they didn't think was possible. Yeah. That's why I live the way I do right now.
It's, there's so much there. But focusing on that last part about that. So when I did a TED Talk almost a couple of years ago. And it was about, the most important story we tell ourselves, which is that self-talk that you talk about. It's the negative self-talk, and it's the, when I'm doing my research, it's the subconscious that's there protecting them from whatever their youth, whatever it was that they environment to grow up in. So it's with you all the time. And it gets to be the part where that's what you expect. It's the negative self-talk, or, I'm not good enough. I can't do this. I'm not X, Y, Z. Right. And it sounds like that's what you've discovered that as well. And the ability to unlock that with some, positive self-talk and visualizations. And I'm sure you have a bunch of other tools that go along with that. It is such a freeing thing to do. And I think you ended up being a nun from the standpoint of helping people, and you do it from a very selfless point of view. I mean, you're selfish in that you want to make other people better, but it's giving to other people. So I think you ended up being a nun, whether you call it that or not. You took the circuitous route to get there. But I think you ended up doing the same thing, right? You ended up with the probably even a better impact, because you you bring credibility and experiences and stuff that only living through that can do. You could read all the books that you want, but I find that if you've lived it, you can tell that story with credibility, and you can use the words and the emotions that that your audience needs to hear, wants to hear, can attach to. Like you said, after the first episode, they're a little hesitant because they've been, lied to or misled before, because it sounded good, right? You get that other thing. Yeah, that's what I need. But you provide that second layer of actually showing, again, using the words and stuff. And that's just what I gathered out of all that stuff that you said in the conversation. Am I pretty close there?
You're spot on. You're spot on. You're right. It's not just, I'm not one for visualization. You can visualize till the cows come home. And there are some that, I guess there's some validity to it, but there is an imagery process that I go through with some clients that it does use imagery, but they create the image and I just guide them to a certain place where they choose three objects in a small cabin. And I don't tell them what to pick. I said, just, there are shelves all around you. Tell me what you see. And, with their eyes closed, they will tell me what they see. I said, now pick three, any three you want. And what they're choosing, whether they realize it or not, is or answers to some of the questions they have been seeking for years in a subjective form in that object. So they gather up their objects, and I have a wise one who's someone they feel safe with, and it can look like whoever they want, a wise one, so they feel safe. Carry those three objects out, and then have them, once they're away and on their path back, ask them, what does this mean to you? What does this particular object mean to you? And they come to their own revelation. I don't give it to them. It's all in us. We just don't know how to access it. So just, this, if you visualize it, it will come, I think, is just a fourth of it. It's not all of the thing. If that were the case, we'd live in some kind of, Disney world.
Yeah. Well, I think the visualization, if done properly, I know the way that I've used it is it's sometimes it acts as a, to me, as a validation of work that I'm doing on other sides of it.
Yes.
Right. Yes. For example, mm-hmm. you know, it's I call fighting with the inner bully. I call mine Simon. I give mine a name. He has an English accent, wears a t-shirt. He's sort of British. I think you might know who I'm talking about, but it's, you know, it's, they tell you you're not good enough. And I've learned to ask, well, prove it to me. Right. So in that case, sir, I'm it's again, not visualization or manifestation, which some of this stuff comes to. If you don't take action, if you're not making changes, like you said, this is something like watching a movie. You have to use it as sort of fuel or validation, yeah. or like you said, the object that I am, that is my mentor. That's the wise one. What do you, does help you unlock those things, which your subconscious has sort of put blinders on, is put in the basement.
Yes, it's true. And you know, it works that way for individuals and oddly enough for corporations who I work with a good bit. They always wonder why, if they bring in someone to do a rah-rah session with their people and introduce a new process, it'll last maybe a week if they're lucky too. And then people go right back to doing things the way they did before. And they can't understand why. Well, it's the limiting beliefs that are inside of them that cause them to go back to a known. This other thing is an unknown. It doesn't feel safe. Even though our knowns may be negative, they are there to protect us. Mentally, that's how we see them. Yeah. In our conscious mind. So
they're familiar, they're comfortable.
Yes. So when I go into a company, I do group hypnosis on different areas, whether sales group or it could be marketing group or even accounting groups, to see where the limiting beliefs are. And most importantly, the CEO, because, you know, it's going to trickle from the top down. And it's more than one time when I've had a CEO ask me, so have you uncovered the problem? I said, I absolutely have. Are you going to tell me? Do you really want to know?
Yeah.
And I've had to tell them,
look in the mirror.
I'm sorry. The problem is your limiting beliefs. And it's only after very, I don't want to use the word cautious, but gentle explanations that they understand how they've created that environment, and they're more than willing to do what it takes to change it.
Yeah, you're telling. So, you know, as an author, there's, although you sort of broke all the rules when you were telling me when your first book came out, we were talking about earlier. You know, there are rules, but then there's always the outlier that because there's an audience for that. There is an audience for things that don't necessarily fit that typical hero's journey or the structure of those things. And oftentimes I think that some authors, they miss an opportunity to really impact the world in a larger way by impacting this group of people that are the non-traditional, that are that do like things a little differently, not the predictable way of doing things that, you know, you obviously addressed with that. But you found the genre, like I said, you had to sort of look up the word. You found that group, your tribe, I would call it, and you've been true to that. You've had that. So when you're telling a story, in a book, that's a longer form, but I think you use storytelling although you're helping other people tell their story with the mind training and stuff that you do. And that's what I try to do from the purpose of the podcast, is how do you unlock that ability to tell your own story by using tools or techniques and stuff. And you're there as sort of the facilitator of this, getting them on the right path to get the guy. And then again, let them blossom and bloom.
Mm-hmm.
So how
a lot of people are afraid to go there.
Yeah.
You know, you ever hear somebody that can't handle being in quiet places? they'll walk in their home, have to turn on the radio, the television, the cars, the radio. They can't handle the silence because it makes them think. It makes them really, you know, because your subconscious is your mind, your conscious mind wants to understand, why do I keep self-sabotaging myself? And your subconscious, your critical mind, which separates your conscious and subconscious, says, okay, you're not getting in here to find out. So instead of going through that discomfort, you just blurt it, you know, you blur it with noise.
Yeah. It's, I guess this is a different form of writer's block. you're sort of, you get down to that one place and it's, I know when I was going through and writing the TED talk and all that, you know, I did that, the self-discovery pieces and stuff. Yeah. I was really having one. I'm a procrastinator. That's a whole other thing that I go on to wait till the last minute to do some things. But as I was doing the research and then these things started to make sense, you know, it started to say, well, I suffer from that. I suffer from that. You had to face that bully. You had to cross that chasm. Like I said, the critical mind, you had to figure out a way to punch through. And I did it on my own through the research and stuff on that. But how do you help other people sort of cross that chasm? Again, you can't force them to go. You have to sort of show them how to find the door that they can go do that themselves.
Hypnosis helps them, helps a lot, because it puts a person in more, a more relaxed state. Of course, you have to develop rapport where they trust you.
Right.
It brings them more into a relaxed state. And as they're going into, I hate the word trance because it makes it sound like Edgar Casey or, you know, it's not that way. It's almost like, you know, when you're driving down a long road without stores or signs up on the side of the road, you kind of go, your brain is somewhere else. You're paying attention to your driving, but it's called road hypnosis.
Yeah.
Hypnosis is similar to that. And I take them down a path that shows them, for example, one of them is having them come to a staircase. And at the top of the staircase is a mirror. And I have them look at it and imagine that they're seeing the person they really want to be. I said, take all the stuff you hear in your head, let it go, and just look in the mirror, right? This is your mirror. There's no one standing around. No one's here to judge you. What does that look like? And then they have it when when you have that picture in your head, give me a short nod, and they do. And then I take them down a flight of 20 stairs. And with every step, I strengthen that. I'll count the steps down. And with every step down, that scene, that image gets stronger. I go 18, stronger, deeper, 60. You see, and by the time they get to the bottom, then they have their face to door, they're faced with a doorway. I have them go through quite a few deepening techniques. Now, once they cross into, they open the door and they're crossing into this room. I said, now, remember, you are the person that's entering is the you have always wanted to be, inside and out. They're walking in the room now. Inside is this golden light that when it starts covering you, but it almost feels like warm milk. And what it's doing is solidifying that image you have in your mind of who you are, truly are. It's solidifying it so no one can break through it. And you can see the smile start spreading across their face as their eyes are closed. And from there, you know, I walk them out. They are who they imagined, who they want to be. And when they go back up those stairs and I count them out, you're talking to a different person already. And that's just after one session.
Yeah, I've done some meditation where I've had those things of the light and the stuff that's done. So meditation along with the mindset training, I meditate every morning, which I always thought meditation was a little bit like yoga, where you'd sit there and, you know,
yeah.
And it's not that way for me. I mean, for some people it is. For me, it's that time where I can sort of just quiet and focus the mind a little bit. Sort of like you're talking about, is trying to open that door or open, you know, leave some openings in there that I can explore and find out. Mm-hmm. You know, I did an exercise this morning with a coach. He was talking about, you know, tell in a paragraph, sort of describe the character of the story of my life. And he had a whole bunch of questions that we filled out earlier and stuff. And it was, you know, like, what sports did I play? What did I do? How do I see myself? What are my values and stuff? And as I'm doing this, and as I'm writing the character, you know, it brought home, not that it's a bad thing, but I did the discovery piece of there that, and maybe it's a topic for a book, you know, how to go through life. You know, I've been very successful with what I've done in my career. But it hasn't been from a focused perspective of I've got to do this X, Y, Z. You know, I got a little bit like you were driven before you sold your business. You know, you had a different focus. You wanted, I've never been that way. I've been sort of along the path, and my goal is always to help other people be better, to unlock some things. That's where I get the most gratitude is coming up. And that's why in the sales, I get to work with customers. At the end of the day, I'm helping them solve a problem. It's not really sales. I'm helping to do that. And it just sort of solidified that vision. But along the way, there's also the things of I get shiny object syndrome. Sometimes I think I'm guilty of not wanting to be in that quiet room as well to focus. And you know, I envision myself as this, you know, Tony Robbins character to a certain extent. Or actually, I think Mike Rowe would be more appreciated. I really like his storytelling style. But, you know, there's that area there. Okay, how do I balance that time to focus on myself and the individual needs with the family and, you know, the other things? So that's my own demon as it came up as you were telling that story. And I was, you know, talking about the hypnotherapy and all that. I still, you know, I have those demons every day. I get up, not demons, but, you know, we have this thing, and it's easy to fall back in that old habit because it's warm, it's comfortable. Sure. It's what you know, right? It takes no effort to stay there. It takes a lot of effort to try to change.
Oh, yes, it does. But it takes a brave soul, and it's only been the ones who have taken a step out of the, you know, where the rest of the sheep are going, that have really made a name for themselves. But Mother Teresa, Thomas Edison, in any path you look,
yeah,
there was someone that stepped away from the herd and did it differently.
Yeah. I heard of somebody's on a podcast that said Thomas Edison was a jerk, but that's a whole other story. So as you, you know, now that you're adult and you decided what you wanted to do when you're grown up and all mm-hmm. that, and you're being that nun, although it's nun in name, I guess in name only. But the not in name only, but in the deeds that you're doing and in the attack that you're taking, helping other people. What's next? I mean, do we have some more books and stuff in the side? Because you obviously have a following, and obviously writing those things is a catharsis for you, I think, at some point in time. But I know you want, this is your chance to really give back. You know, the nonprofit to help reading. I know. My youngest daughter was a voracious reader. You know, she couldn't wait to get the next Harry Potter book and stay up the next day and a half to go through it and read through it. She reads a ton of stuff. And I like to read too. Mine are more, I did like Harry Potter. I thought she was a good writer. She told a good story. There was a lot of texture and stuff there. But I like Tom Clancy as well, because he would tell stories on multiple levels. And I always liked that sort of spy game. So I like that. Then, you know, then reading other people, Tim Ferriss, Tribe of Mentors, where he interviewed a whole bunch of different people. My problem is being a polymath. I have a lot of different interests. And I before I take an action, I said, well, I don't have enough information. I have the problem of getting to the point where I've got enough to start. And I can, that's help me out. How can I, fix that?
It's good having varied interests. Because then you get a flavor of everything. And when you start putting your own stuff down, you have tasted, it's like going into Baskin Robbins and you, you know, chocolate may be your favorite, but boy, that looks good. And that looks good. And, you know, they'll give you the little sample cups. So by the time you get through tasting all of them, you're not really hungry anymore, but you've had a chance to taste everything. So when you write, that variety, that flavor variety shows up in your writing, which makes it richer. So I don't think sticking with one is, if anything, it just makes you stagnant. You know, reading across the genre ropes. I hate the word genre, you know, I really do, because it's like, it's your story. This is my story. Why do you want to stick it in a genre? They wanted to stick mine in horror. I said, my books are not horror. The horror books I've read and put down are blood, guts, and gore. And that's not my, that's not my style. It was, but it is psychological, paranormal stuff.
Yeah. Well, that's, and, I mean, some people that is horrifying. To other people, it's just really interesting things happen.
Yeah, yes.
You know, I used to read, there were legends of ghosts in the area. We used to go out and hunt for the lights. You know, there was a legend of somebody fell off a train, got his head cut off, and he's out there hunting for his head. You know, there were all these different things that you would go see. Swamp gas was always a good fodder for as you're probably familiar with, fodder for some tales that go on. So I mean, I think as a young person too, we like to be scared. I think I like to be scared. So horror falls into play. I paranormal type things, it does scare me. It's, you know, because I believe that it is out there. I just don't know whether it's good or bad.
It's both.
Yeah. Well, there's good and bad, but that's fitting though, because there's evil and there's good in the world.
Yes.
Seem to think somebody, you know, there is no evil. It's just simply they're a victim of their circumstances. Well, that's not necessarily true. Sometimes there is evil. Sometimes it is bad. But yeah. Anyway, and now you got me going off on something else. So, what's the best way to get a hold of you in this new, you know, with the business you got going on, the nonprofit and all? What's the best way to learn more about?
They can go to the website mindpaththerapies.com. And in fact, if they want to just talk about what they're going through, if we're fit, I always offer a free 15-minute consultation so they can just chat. If they want to see about the books, they can go to DeborahLeBlanc.com, and all my books are listed there. So if you Google Deborah LeBlanc, you might be surprised at some of the places I'll show up.
I did that before this came happen, and that got me off on one of those finding the end of the internet thing. Okay, where's the real Deborah? I had to keep looking. Okay, well, that looks like her in that picture. I had to keep going around comparing pictures.
Yes.
There's not a single, it is that long and wide. I called it a long, winding P-row boat ride.
Yes, it is. Only I would never get in a P-row. A skiff, yes. A P-row, no.
Okay, well, only the people that grew up where we did will understand what that is. I have to go.
Right.
But Deborah, thanks for sharing your journey with us. It was very fascinating. It's not often that I get where I'm totally, I couldn't ask a question for a bit because I was just so in the moment of what you were, the story you were telling. You were hypnotizing me, I'm pretty sure of it. But the story you had, you're doing some great things for the world. And I really appreciate what you and appreciate you being on the podcast.
Thank you for having me, Doug. And you're doing the same. You're giving back. And I really appreciate that. The world needs it.
Well, thanks a lot. Yeah, the world, with COVID, we need some help. So there is hope. Just look around the edges. You'll find it.
That's right.